down the spoon, then taken a discreet sip of water. He said nothing. The next 60 seconds were occupied with the wet, semi-ashamed sounds of people eating soup.
If we're going to do these awful shared meals, at least someone provide conversation, said Mercy waspishly.
She was removing thick pieces of root vegetable and eating them delicately off her fork.
I can't bear to sit here and eat mediocre food in silence. I can do that by myself.
You said, after a moment, to peel up the edges of your words.
Is it mediocre, elder sister? I followed a recipe.
Cassiopeias. Now there was a woman who could cook, said Augustine, and his granite-coloured eyes grew soft and nostalgic in his long, hawk-featured face. Not without injuring herself, mind. John, do you remember that time she took half her finger off getting the meat out of that coconut? She didn't tell anybody until after we'd eaten the meal. That's a lesson for you, Harrow Hark. Confess first thing, before we find a finger in the soup.
You flinched, then tried to smile. Perhaps that was called for.
Ianthe looked at the expression on your face and shuddered visibly.
What's the meat in here flavouring the broth? If there's chunks, it's all rendered down.
You closed your eyes and tried to think.
It was so difficult. You so badly wanted to sleep. You were doing so many things at once. Your sole remaining powers of concentration were given over to this moment. For a second or two, you forgot the word that you were looking for. It was on the tip of your tongue, while you were building, minutely, stromal cell by stromal cell.
Marrow, you said.
The saint of duty exploded outward as your construct emerged from his abdomen. Your soup was watery and mediocre, as soup went, but as a delivery method for gelid explosives, marrow rendered through so much water as to not pass comment, it was perfect. Half a dozen arms shattered him in the soft electric light from the overhead panels. You let out your breath, and coalescing scythes destroyed intestines, lungs, heart. Then you fired upward toward the brain. And God said, "Stop!" The world slowed down. Augustine and Mercy Morn stopped, arrested in the act of half-rising from their seats. Ianthe stopped, left arm paused, outflung to shield her face. You stopped, sitting upright in your chair, your bones somehow rigid and still, and your flesh chilly and rigid around those bones. The shrapnel spray from the saint of duty did not stop. It cascaded across the table like the crest of a pink waterfall, pitter-pattering down on bowls and the tablecloth and the polished dark surface of the wood. But what remained of him stopped too, half man, half rupture, his prurient details hot and white, naked insides clothed with the sinus-drying burst of the power of God. The Emperor of the Nine Houses, the resurrection, the first reborn, sat at the end of the table, his plain face splattered with gore, and his eyes were the death of light. The Necrolord Prime said very calmly,
10,000 years since I've eaten human being, Harrow, and I didn't really want an encore. Now tell me what you have done.
Your body was unyielding, but your mouth had purchase. You said,
I reconfigured a clump of marrow stem cells into sesamoid bone. From the sesamoid bone, I made a construct.
Harrow Hark, he said, you cannot have perceived foreign bone marrow within the body of a lictor. I'm not sure Mercy could perceive it with her arms draped around Autus the whole time.
The cells weren't foreign.
What?
I sectioned my tibia for the soup, you said.
God's eyes closed very briefly. He pushed his bowl another fraction away. You stared down the table at him, at the blank, remote faces of your two nominal teachers, at the frozen, ivory stillness of Ianthe, her hair now whitish-pink, at space outside the window, where the asteroids themselves seemed to hang in tranquilized arrest. He said, "You must know that I won't let either of you kill the other before my very eyes, Harrow."
"He attacked me in my rooms. He drained my personal wards."
"Coming from the Saint of Duty, that's a compliment."
"You said, 'Lord, I am hunted. I perish.'"
"Harrow."
"I don't come to you as Harrowhark the First,"
your mouth said.
"I come to you as a supplicant. I can't live like this. Lord, do I displease you that you shield him and not me? I understand that I am a sharpened twig beside your keenest sword, but why do you suffer this twig to live? I can't live this way. I cannot live this way. I have nowhere to go. I have nobody to turn to. I am a nonsense."
You looked at each other down that long, bloody table.
God said, "Harrowhark, when was the last time you slept?"
It was with all the dignity of the locked tomb, the chill of the stone that had been rolled, and of the bones that had been laid, and of the still salt water that shimmered before the whitened monument where your holy monster lay, that you said,
"6 days ago."
The Emperor of the Nine Houses stood. The spell, whatever it had been, dropped like a white sun setting. Your body collapsed back into your chair, the construct gamely clambering out of the Saint of Duty, dwindled to a powder of pink dust. The shard you had been driving up the cervical vertebrae to the base of the spine and the brain within its casing simply disappeared. Destroyed or removed, you could not tell. The concatenation of Ortus the First's insides, laced and crocheted over the dinner table, sizzled away to a soft mist. Everyone's breath spewed from their lungs in one unholy gasp. Ortus's hands flew to his middle. The Emperor did not give anyone time to react further. He said, evenly,
"Dinner is over. Let us leave the table. Ianthe, take your sister to bed."
Everyone began clattering out of their chairs in a wild scraping of wood and tile. Augustine said, "My lord," and God said,
"Go. Just go."
You felt strange and unreal as a white-lipped Ianthe hauled you up from your seat. The skin she touched was merely a thin and pervious netting keeping in your meat, which consisted of 10,000 spiders. She slung your arm across her shoulders as though you were an invalid. Perhaps you were. Your legs did not feel correct. Your eldest sister, looking distinctly green around the gills and checking long strands of her overripe rose hair for globs, had also risen. But the Emperor said,
"You, stay,"
and she froze. There was no thought in you of fighting Ianthe as she walked you away. You could have gone meekly to the slaughter without a muzzle or a leash. Behind you, the kindly prince was saying in far more ominous tones than you had ever heard him use,
"6 days, no sleep. She still manages a full skeleton commencement from diluted marrow. What else have you failed to see, Mercy Morn?"
You were already at the door when her peevish response came.
"But this is insane! She's only 9 years old!"
The saints of duty and patience were out in the corridor. If either had wanted to run you through, you could not have stopped them. You looked at them, despite Ianthe urging you away. At Augustine, looking as though he had seen the ghost of someone he did not particularly like, and at Ortus. Ianthe kept trying to turn you to face forward, but you kept watching even as she hustled you down the corridor. You saw Augustine fumble for a cigarette, light it with the little silver arc lighter he kept in his breast pocket, and pass it silently to his brother Lictor. Autus was impassive. There was not a trace of blood on his clothing. There was not a stray lump of viscera upon the shabby shirt, nor on the mother-of-pearl cloak still slung over his shoulder. There was no betrayal of any emotion on his face, not the surprise that had dawned over his heavy-lidded eyes earlier, nor anger, nor even dissatisfaction. He caught your gaze. You held his. And the saint of duty lifted his lit cigarette to you in an unmistakable salute.
Chapter 26.
One day, Harrow Hark's eye was caught by the rain drizzling outside on the docking terrace, and by black figures rising in the fog. They were on the very edge of the terrace. She tugged her hood deep down over her head, walked outside into the rain. She kept bone chips clutched between her knuckles so that they would not grow wet from sweat or weather, and approached. One of the black figures resolved itself in that grey, stinking blanket of cloud, large and imposing, like the midday sun amid clouds. It was Coronabeth Tridentarius. She was turned away from Harrow, and her riot of hair, half caught in a fillet, half escaping, was soaking wet, a dark and crinkling amber in the rain. She was not fighting or arguing. She was still as a statue, and ready and waiting as a dog. The figure behind her was much smaller and slighter, the aseptic robes of his office a bleached blued grey with the water. The braid pinned high on his head was so pale as to be white, and his rain-sodden chain-mail kirtle gleamed wetly amid the fog. At her creeping pace, Harrow Hark had covered only half the distance when she heard Silas Octokyseron say, clear above the patter of falling drops,
"And somewhere out there, may all the blood of your blood suffer even a fraction of what I have suffered."
He pushed. The eldest princess of Ida dropped from the side of the docking bay with swan-like ease. She simply tipped off the side, neither folding nor seizing, there one moment a golden star, and then gone. There was no question of going to her aid. The eighth house necromancer stood there, with the wind flapping his wet alabaster robes, his braid torn to wisps and ribbons, and he did not even look over the side. But he did look to Harrow Hark.
"Defend yourself, Octokyseron!" she called out. "The Black Vestals have only one answer for murder."
"The Black Vestals only ever had one answer for anything," was the reply, in his profoundly deep, gorge-like voice.
He looked at her. From their distance of about five bodies apart, his eyes were umbrous in his white and stricken face.
"The question came, why?" And the Black Vestals said, "Because." "Now you have come to me, you cur of the night-time, you fry of slavery. You have done what you have done, and you say to me, 'Defend yourself.' How could I?"
"I don't give a damn about white glass mysteries or cryptics," she said. "I care that you just pushed one of the Tridentari to her death."
"Death," said Silas.
He looked out again at all the rolling fog, at the clouds that obscured the grinding sea down to which Coronabeth was most likely still falling. From closer up, Harrow saw that he was all in disarray. His clothes were smudged, and a few of his buttons were not done up. The rain and the fog had lashed him terribly. Harrow took her hands from her pockets and strewed her chips upon the ground. From each chip she felt a pop, pop, pop at the back of her brain from the thalagy expenditure. She unfurled a full appendicular skeleton, extending the bone in a hurry so that none of the cortex could mix with water. The dull gleam of their compact bone shone like marble in the wet. Silas Octokyzeron looked at her five full constructs with his lip curling.
"Her filthiness is on her feet," he murmured. "She has not remembered her end."
"For God's sake, raise your hands, Octokyzeron," she said, "or make me strike down an unarmed man."
And Silas said,
"Is this how it happens, then?"
He turned away. She saw what he meant to do, and her skeletons skittered forward on the rain-slick concrete of the docking terrace. But it was for nothing. Silas Octokyzeron had launched himself fearlessly into space after the tumbling body of Coronabeth Tridentarius. He fluttered in the wind and rain briefly, like a dirty white bird, and disappeared. She pushed through her skeletal crowd to stand at the edge. They held her arms back for safety, and stared down into the virginal and unbroken bank of salty, reeking fog. There was no sign of either adept. From far below, the ocean howled. Harrow thought she perceived a tatter of something penetrate the cloud. Her heart pounded rhythmically in her ears, and she thought she saw, absurdly, a sudden gush of watery blood, as though the fog itself had been knifed. But it was gone almost as soon as she had seen it. Chapter 27 You lost a great interstice of time. The next thing you knew, you were staring at the shadowy bowels of a room, lit only by a soft yellow puddle of light, a bedside table lamp, sheets slippery and cool over you. For the first time in your life, when you tried to let yourself panic and generate an adrenaline spike, it did not work. That trigger had broken. After too many days of generating cortisol, your pituitary gland was taking an unsanctioned holiday somewhere far away from you, and all you could do was lie bewildered in these unfamiliar surrounds. Not so unfamiliar. After many long and stupid moments, you realized that you had been laid to rest in the white and gold confection of Ianthe's bed, with its chilly satin coverlet and the lilac flowers embroidered in silk floss on almost every inch of the bedclothes. You willed yourself into panic again, flailing against the mattress, and sputtered out dolefully. "Lie back down," said the Princess of Ida. She was standing before the windows. The amethyst dripping from her rapier's basket hilt flashed and glittered in the darkness. She had her left arm tucked behind her, and her feet arranged a hip's width apart, and her right arm extended before her, holding her sword. She was moving the sword into mechanical attitudes, blade pointed high, blade pointed low, wrist twisted to sweep the blade into position. You struggled to sit up. Your head felt as though someone had studded your skull with fine little spikes that stroked your brain with hooked barbs whenever you moved.
"I said lie down," said Ianthe. "You absolute madwoman," she added, without any particular emotion. "Can't believe I ate a whole bowl of none. I should have made myself throw up."
The Princess of Ida sounded unlike herself. This was a more detached Ianthe. Ianthe as an arm pulled from the socket. Ianthe as a tooth torn from the root. Your head was so heavy. For a moment, it was as though you were back on the Erebos again, when you had been made of cotton wool and black fog. She changed form. The rapier came down low over her left side, swung slowly to cover the right, flicked up in a steel shimmer so that the tip of the sword pointed at the ceiling on guard, then to the left again, then swinging high to absorb an imagined blow to the head and shoulders. Parry positions, which you should have known but didn't.
Ianthe was training in her nightgown, a grisly floor-length concoction of pale golden lace that made her long, limber body look like a green-veined mummy, and even you could tell that her movements were ungainly and belaboured. It took you a long time to say, "Augustine," and she answered, immediate, impatient, "Are you still awake?" "Yes. One might have hoped that your light dinner-time entertainment would have given me an extension, but not so much." You said feebly, "The saint of duty, Autus, can suck wards." Ianthe said something very coarse in response. Then she said, "So that's why you stopped sleeping. Well, if he wants to attack you while you are here, I tell you truthfully that I welcome that inferno. But sleep, Harry. You were very weak. You felt an exhaustion beyond tiredness, a drugged, unstable fatigue. When you laid your head back against Ianthe's pillow, you smelled the thin, putrefying off-apple smell from her bedside table. And you smelled her, and that scent was now familiar. It was the animal yearning for the familiar that undid you. You closed your eyes, and you were asleep." How long you slept, you did not know. You did not know what dawn of which day you woke to. The daytime lights filtered through the hangings of the four-poster bed with a warm whiteness, a lemony warmth limning the naked paintings that festooned the walls. It felt as though you had slept for 100 years. The satin coverlet was cool against your arms, and you lay in Ianthe's bed insensate, comfortable. Gradually, you felt a heavy weight in a depression next to you. You rolled onto your side, suddenly and deeply frightened that you might see the bed's owner. Your sword had been laid atop the covers beside your body, on the eiderdown, the bone scabbard gleaming a dull grey in the imitation sunlight. This was, in every single way, a better thing to wake up to than the face of Ianthe, love my twin, also murder, Tridentarius. Then you heard breathing. It was with unexpected clarity of mind and soul that you pushed the eiderdown away and crawled to the end of the bed, and you found Ianthe before you, on the floor. She was belly down on one of the cream and gold rugs on the deep, honey-coloured plush carpet, and all around her was a growing crimson mass of blood. She sprawled in a puddle of red, as though it was her shadow. Her long hair tumbled over her face and shoulders like a veil, and she grunted hard through her teeth, breathing in long, terrible breaths like a dying animal. As you watched, a silent spectator on her mattress, she propped herself on her elbows and grasped the ruddy crimson blade of her trident knife in both hands, and she thrust it furiously into the intolerable seam of her right arm. Ianthe struck again and again. The wound kept healing over. The skin sewed itself back up even as she pulled the blade away. Blood coalesced around the seam in a serried row of teeth, of needles, and these she used to try to lever herself apart, but her elbow wobbled beneath her, and she collapsed on the sodden carpet. She dropped the knife from nerveless fingers. She slapped that almost imperceptible seam, then again. Then she gave a low and broken moan, and fell over onto her side, curled fetally inward. Your mind was clear. Your thoughts were warm and tidy, as though they had been put through the sonic cleaner. It was with very little trepidation that you dropped to your knees beside her. You rolled her onto her back, and she looked at you with terrified eyes, half blue, part brown, with fragments of lavender. Her mouth was an ugly twist, contemptuous of herself. You had seen that expression 1,000,000 times in your mirror, but never on her. "Harrow," she said unsteadily. She was trembling. "You're a fool," you said.
How I crave your honeyed words, said Ianthe. Her mouth was almost purple from the pain. How I love your tender compassion. This was rank hypocrisy, but you were too focused to care. You said, it needs to come off all at once. What? Get something to bite down on. She looked at you, her eyes a wild confusion of colours. She lay spread before you in her hideous buttercup nightgown, which was now a party-coloured mix of gold and pink and red, like a liver. After a moment, she nodded. She ripped a bloodied swatch of yellow lace from her skirt, and she compressed it into a tight cylinder and pressed it between her teeth. Her teeth were very white, and her tongue was wet and red. You raised yourself up on your knees, swaying a little, and you pictured her for what she really was, an exquisite conglomeration of bone beneath skin and meat, pocketed in the middle with soft treasures of parenchyma and muscle. When you placed your hands upon her ribs, you were able to see her skeleton as though she had shyly undressed herself for you, as though in the orange hues of the daytime light she'd sloughed capillaries and glands off the budding rose of her scapula. You saw the curve of her clavicle, bowed softly as the line of some drooping bellflower. It was so easy. Now that you had slept, everything was easy. It was as though you had been walking in a lead casing, and now you were free. As before any difficult work, you prayed out loud, prayed for the rock to go unrolled and for the closed eye and the stilled brain, prayed for a woman you loved to assist you in disrobing a woman you did not, but whose bones you would sacramentally adore. You kneeled on her thighs and unsheathed a great shank of bone from your knuckles. Ianthe bucked, just the once, and you sharpened the edge to a translucent liquid thinness. With one cut, you took the arm. You scythed through the knob of ligament and scapula and removed the humerus. Ianthe screamed through her mouthful of lace. The blood came like a spring tide over your front, and you felt it soak through your clothes and trickle down your navel. You cauterized the meat all at once, pinching the vessels closed, reaching down to press your fingers against where the humeral head had been. Then you covered over the gap with spongiform bone to give you a platform to work on, and you spun her shoulder beneath your fingers, and it squirmed at your touch. Ianthe's screams had subsided to ravenous whimpers. Her arm had to be her own. That was no difficulty. You coaxed fine webby strands of red marrow from the wing of bone that girdled her shoulder, and from that, from minute osteoblastic grit, from the maze-like netting of the bone that swaddled the sponge and the marrow, you remade her. The humerus was child's play, and you took genuine pleasure in socketing it into the lovely cup of the radius, the forked embrace of the ulna. Her trochlea you sculpted while holding your breath, easing it into its wet white housing. The hand was almost an indulgence. The skeleton recalled itself. You did not need to know so intimately the lover's knot of carpal bones, the long tooth of her lunate, the jutting promontory of her trapezium. Nor did you need to know the arch of the distal phalange, the shaft, the base. The new bones sprang avidly to meet your fingers, as though you were lovers joining hands after a long time apart. Your role with the bones was more guide than artist. The artistry would come at this point, and you warned her. This will hurt. Ianthe rocked upward. You knew your limits. You had understood what to do with her body innately, and it was not what she wanted, but you thought it would suffice. You blistered the bone and tendons only where you thought it was necessary for range of motion. You bubbled nerves into that shining periosteum where nerves had never been before. Not a full compliment,
but just enough. Bone would call to bone, and nerve would call to brain. When you trailed your fingers up that new trunk of electrified humerus, she almost spat out the chunk of lace. When you pressed your palm into her shoulder and plugged her in, she sobbed rhythmically beneath you. What was left at the end was not an arm. It was a construct, a sectioned skeleton, defleshed. When you sat down beside her, you were chilly with sweat and pleasantly tired, as though you had run a good distance. You watched as the Ianthe took the saliva-sodden wad of nightgown from her teeth, and, as shaking, she raised her new arm up to the light. The warm electric lamplight made her naked arm bones an iridescent gold. The old arm lay on the carpet, abandoned and dead, looking a little sorry for itself. You said, "I didn't bother about the meat." Ianthe said wonderingly, "But I've got some feeling in it. Most of the nervous glands are in your elbow. Why, even... You have worked out that the literal healing process is dependent on your nerve fibers. But you don't... I lack entirely what you all have," you said, "and have had to work out a replacement. I watched and compared. In the beginning, I thought maybe I could implant the process in myself. But it's not just a matter of nerves, even if those signal the reconstruction. I thought, if I experienced enough pain, something might kick in to save me. It didn't." She spread her rightmost finger bones wide, then back, experimentally making a fist. You said, "You will still need a mat of tissue or cartilage on the palmar bones to hold the sword. Think of it as a glove." Ianthe rolled away from you, damp with drying blood. You watched as she stood before the amethyst-studded rapier she had left in its scabbard, and you watched her slide it out slowly, with a soft metallic sound that set your teeth on edge. You watched her web her skeleton hand with a neon pad of fat. Not your preference, but she had her own proclivities, and raised the sword behind her, gauging the new weight in an arm substantially lighter than the one on the floor, and close her eyes. "Lunge!" The arm answered. The movement was reactive, liquid, smooth. She cut a sweep before her, then flicked her naked wrist. Each action was clean. The sword was as light in her hand as the bones in her arm. Her body was not her body. It was strange to you, how you could see no trace of idle Ianthe in the parry and the thrust. Instead, you saw a cavalier who had known from the cradle what life intended for him, and had a rapier placed in his hands not long after. You might have changed your clothes or washed the blood from your body. All your sister Lictor did was throw her nacreous white robe over her shoulders, where it settled like snow under an aurora. All she did was belt her rapier to her waist and slide the trident knife into the special scabbard across the hip, and point at you and say, "I'll be back in 15 minutes. Do not leave the room." You were still weary and frightened, and Ianthe leaving reminded you how vulnerable you really were. But Ianthe did not heed your protests, nor did she take 15 minutes. You sat yourself back on the bed and pulled the covers up around your shoulders, and very slowly and surely your heart rate returned to normal. It was fully 25 minutes before the door opened again. You coiled for flight, but it was, after all, just Ianthe. An Ianthe who had changed. She was a sorry sight. You had an artist's fondness for the right arm, but recognized the shocking juxtaposition of it, of the bloodless flesh and then the bloodless bone, that unexpected and violent nudity. Her yellow lace nightgown had dried to a crust of brown, and her hair had dried in patches of much the same colour, a sort of carroty stain at the temples and the ends. But the expression on her face was that of undressed release.
It was the expression of an awed child watching their raised skeleton totter forward for the first time without falling. She was incandescent, softly luminous in a way that gave her bleached skin a creamy colour, and which made the death mask lines of her blank face animated and alive. Her eyes were blue again, with those mountainous flecks of sea-parted brown. And for the first time you thought how much she resembled her twin. She was still grasping her lovely third rapier in her skeleton hand, the blade naked to you, and she said, not bothering to hide her excitement, "Shit, it's going to break."
"Not in a hurry, Tridentarius. That's regenerating ash."
"There wasn't the same weight behind my thrust."
"He didn't compensate."
She swung her sword in a slow, glittering arc, revolving her wrist. Ianthe said, not unhumorously,
"Naberius always compensated."
You asked, "What did Augustine the First say?"
"Nothing," she said, and she started to laugh. Peals of bell-like laughter. She dropped to sit on the bed and exulted.
"Nothing much. He dropped me into the river, went 2 rounds against my body. It worked, Nona Jesmus. It worked. He says it's hideous and he'll gild it for me.
Tacky, you said,
but I can fight the same way I fought after I became a lictor, before I lost the arm. I'm real. I work. Harry, I am a lictor."
Her jubilance was infectious. "It did not hurt you. You were not a lictor."
You said, "You may feel free to thank me any time you so choose."
Ianthe was suddenly beside you on the bed. She had dropped her rapier among the bedclothes, and for the very first time brushed the dry distal tip of her new pointer finger against your cheek. You were vulnerable, but you did not pull away. She tapped you on the cheekbone, and once on the tip of your nose, and then lastly pressed her naked finger to your bottom lip.
"Thank you," she said.
"Harrow, you loved that."
The smooth claw of the finger joint felt cool against your mouth. Her head was quite close to yours. The lace nightgown gapped somewhat at the front. The Princess of Ida said,
"I already know how I'm going to thank you."
And you were bemused. "You absolute idiot baby, you were mystified. You were tired, and you were embarrassed, and you were riding high from the satisfaction of doing one half-perfect thing, of having committed a low miracle of your own devising, of, for a handful of minutes, being Harrowhark Nona Jesimus again, the greatest necromancer produced by your dark and sacred Dreaber." Ianthe took her finger from your lips, looked at you, and smiled a phosphorescent and confidential smile. She said, "I'm going to help you kill the Saint of Duty."
Chapter 28. Days later, the endless rain and lubricious fog turned suddenly to ice. Harrowhark woke up in the unfamiliar annex where she now slept, red and chapped with cold. The second's chambers had been deemed the least leaky of all their rooms on offer, helped by their placement quite low down Canaan House's southmost side, and Lieutenant Dias had invited them to move in with no enthusiasm whatsoever. They had arrayed makeshift beds and mattresses on the floor of her parlour, the broken furniture pushed into corners and stacked up at the sides, and there they all lay like victims after a massacre. They were a ragtag bunch. Abigail Pent and her husband, who shared the decomposing four-poster that the dead Judith Deuteros had slept in, Protesilaus the Seventh and his intubated adept, who slept like a healthy baby swaddled in carpet rugs and robes and all her spare clothes. Dias, who seemed never to want to sleep again, but only to sharpen her rapier to the point where it must have held around 19 edges, and Ortus and herself. Ortus had placed his mattress between all concerned and the door.
"I will be that bulwark,"
he'd said portentously, although Harrowhark had noticed that it was the driest and warmest spot. That was that. That was all of them. When she had asked after the remnant fourth children, Pent had remarked a little casually that she had already moved them on. Harrow read between the lines and found that she could not resent their being squirreled away, so that the rest of the group presented a larger and juicier target. Her breath sparkled in front of her mouth, and her fingers ached, even though she'd slept in gloves. The sun shone thinly through lacy patches of feathery, tessellated mist on the glass. Glass on glass. Ice! All at once, Harrow was homesick for Dreaber. The fog outside was so thick that Canaan House seemed to have ascended into the heavens overnight, risen up into the atmosphere within a thick, wet fleece of cloud and mist, a dirty ovine colour. Harrow could not see the sea or sky. She thought the rain was falling less heavily outside, but then she perceived that instead of the dreary, murmurous fall of precipitation, each drop had hardened into a pellet of ice. The wind whipped them up against the thick plex window, and they sounded like shot from the barrel of a gun. It was not much past dawn. She'd slept in her paint, and her teeth tasted like pigment. Harrow wrapped her veil around her mouth as a muffler and rose silently from her bed. The others slept on in silent hummocks like graves. Ortus before her, a black and faintly waffling hill. On her right, Protesilaus Ebdema, who slept with his sword on his breast, like some soldier's monument, one where the sculptor had gone overboard on the muscles. On his right, his necromancer, her short, buff-coloured curls falling on her childlike cheeks. And on her left, Dias, who lay with her eyes open and her sword on her breast. Her gloves were very white against the steel hilt of her rapier, and very white against the bared sepia of her wrists. The door to Pent's room opened on silent hinges to reveal her kind-eyed, curly-haired, and abominably silly cavalier. He had his slippers on, and two coats over his pyjamas. On seeing Harrowhark, he touched his lips and beckoned her through to his room. Within, Abigail Pent was curled up on an enormous windowsill, a decrepit love seat tattering itself to pieces beneath her, watching the hail come down in calm fascination. There was a roasting smell, like chocolate and dust. A little electric heater blarted out tepid air on the floor, its fans wheezing hotly. To Harrow's numb fingers, it seemed to be warming approximately jack shit. "Pretty foul out there," Pent said in low tones. "Coffee?" That must have been the chocolate scent. Harrowhark accepted a cup, mainly to warm her hands. "The pressure's dropping freakishly, though of course you aren't victim to atmospheric conditions on Dreaber, are you? Are you getting any sleep?" Harrow said merely, "I don't care about surrounds. It could easily be less advantageous." Often her cell had been worse. "Hear, hear," whispered Pent's cavalier, holding the coffee pot, which was wildly belching steam. "That's the stuff. We'll make a fifth of you yet, Reverend Daughter. Not that bad. Can't complain. It'll be a damn sight worse in the river." "Just so long as the Duchess Septimus is holding on," said Abigail, unperturbed by a fresh smash of icy pellets next to her head. "I tried to make her take the bed. She was so upset that the Templar pair weren't on board. I told her that I didn't think we'd get Master Octokaiser on first time round. She won't tell me what he said to her, just that he was horrid."
"Cheeky little so-and-so," said Magnus.
"If he were my son, I'd give him something to think about. I'm not surprised he's gone to ground."
"I would hope your son might be of different character," said his wife, half-smiling.
Protesilaus should have biffed him.
It's strange, said Abigail, ignoring her husband's exhortations to biffing. The eighths are not generally the type to hide. Hera came to an internal decision to tell the truth. It was not particularly difficult. She had only been holding on to the knowledge because a woman whose tongue wagged did not love the silence of the tomb. Also, she was frankly uncertain that what she had seen had been real. But now it was nearly a week later, and she was tired of what Magnus Quinn's eyebrows did when he uttered the word biff. Silas Octokyzeron is not hiding, she said. He's dead. Both of them looked at her. The fifth necromancer's glasses were misting up with the cold, so that her tranquil brown gaze was seen as though through a filmy cataract. Pardon, she said. So is Coronabeth Tridentarius, Harrow added. I cannot confirm the fates of the rest of the third house.
Both of them,
began Magnus, and his wife cut in quickly. The sleeper. Harrowhark said, No. She told the fifth house the story of what she had seen, though she left out the blood in the fog. Magnus and Abigail shared what seemed a very long glance. Magnus looked troubled, and his wife looked set, and strangely resigned. After the awkward length of what passed between them, the cavalier meekly slurped at his coffee cup.
"We should have made him a greater priority," said Lady Pent.
Magnus said,
"I'm not certain."
"And now he is gone," she said, and added, "to say nothing of the third. Reverend daughter, you say this was nearly a week ago. A week, and you didn't think to tell us."
There was a slight accusatory note in Pent's tone. Harrowhark did not feel great about it, but neither did she feel particularly bad. She just felt small and empty and hard, like the hail battering itself so fiercely on the window outside. The heater produced another helpless splurt of dust-smelling heat.
"I had to be sure," she said.
"Of what?" said Magnus.
This did not require an answer, so Harrow Hark did not give one. She merely held her hot coffee between her hands and stared with what she knew to be a slightly smeared but still discomposing painted face with all the white and black of Ninth House sacrament. It was not difficult to win a staring match against Magnus Quinn. He wilted in about 5 seconds and stared out the window and sighed very heavily.
"We didn't need him," he said bracingly.
Abigail said, "We need everyone."
"I never thought he was quite the thing."
"Tridentarius's loss is the greater here," said Harrow Hark repressively, and she thought Abigail sounded somewhat distracted when she said, "Yes, yes, I do think so. I just hadn't expected. If she's gone, then perhaps that means... Reverend daughter, will you do me a very great favour?"
"That depends on what the favour is." "I would like you to read this for me," said Lady Pent. She set down an empty cup of coffee on the frigid windowsill, and she took a little flimsy bag from her pocket. She unzipped the plex tab on the top and removed, delicately, a piece of yellowing paper. The fifth adept used the very edges of her fingernails to unfold it, carefully and tenderly. Harrow stood up at once, but the cavalier was somehow between her and the door. The sweat beaded behind her knees and prickled behind her ears as she glanced down at the paper. Harrow said,
"I would like to bring my cavalier into this conversation."
"You need Ortus the Ninth to read a piece of paper with you," said Magnus Quinn with broad good humour,
the type that was as resolute and inflexible and polite as a summons. She had been stitched up. She was a fool. She had lost her fear of the fifth house, and now she had been boxed in as only the fifth house might box you, smiling the whole time and acting as though the whole thing might be a bit of a joke.
Harrow made her face imperturbable and swallowed slowly so that her throat did not so obviously gulp. She stalled.
The text is small, Pent said. Do you think so?
The fifth necromancer did not let go of the paper. Harrow Hark looked down at its blood-red, panicked writing, a hasty, furious scrawl written with such fury that the pen had bitten the paper.
I will remember the first time you kissed me. You apologized. You said, I am sorry. Destroy me as I am. But I want to kiss you before I am killed. And I said to you, why? And you said, because I have only once met someone so utterly willing to burn for what they believed in. And I loved him on sight. And the first time I died, I asked of him what I now ask of you. I kissed you. And later I would kiss him too, before I understood what you were. And all three of us lived to regret it. But when I am in heaven, I will remember your mouth. And when you roast down in hell, I think you will remember mine.
Harrow read this screed in a flat and affectless monotone, her voice dying away on mine. The cavalier looked at the paper, and his necromancer looked at her.
Read it to me, she said,
knowing her voice was still flat and hard as the hail. Abigail turned the note back to herself, still with the care reserved for some priceless antique. I still get an erotic charge from snakes, sorry to say, she read. There was a brief silence. The hail slapped at the window's glass as though wanting to hurl itself through. There was a growing rime of pale blue frost at the edges, and a cleared mist from where Abigail had sat. Deep in the fast-moving fog outside, unmoved by wind and unresolved by gouts of chilly hail, all three of them watched, a little detached, as tiny particles of ash joined the hail in the storm, as though the already overcrowded weather had been augmented by the eruption of some distant cinder cone.
It differs mildly, then, said Harrow,
and Abigail admitted,
somewhat, yes.
Magnus said, but why?
I am mad, she interrupted. I have always been mad, since I was a child. I hallucinate sounds. I see things that do not exist. Autus has masked much of it, but as you have identified and exploited, my vulnerability only requires his removal. I did not tell you of Silas Octokyseron's death, because I was not sure I was an accurate reporter. I am insane.
Abigail Pent took off her glasses and popped them down into the top fold of her robe. She reached out to touch Harrow's arm, and Harrow flinched away. She winced a little in sympathetic apology and removed her hand.
You have kept that close to your chest, she said. I would like to hear more sometime, if you are ever inclined to tell me. But Harrow Hark, that squares perfectly with another theory I have. If all this time you only looked to your own frustrations, have you ever considered the fact that you might also be...
Here it comes, said her husband wearily, the ghost agenda.
Magnus! Haunted, his wife finished in triumph. Harrow Hark, Nona Jessimus, I really think you should consider the idea that you might also be haunted.
Chapter 29
Augustine was all smiles now that Ianthe the First had passed her final hurdle. His open delight did a lot to ameliorate the reddened, swelling tension that had permeated the Mithraeum. You found his frank and open relief patronizing, but your sister Lictor did not, or at least made a very good show of enjoying it. You went to watch a bout between them in the training rooms, sitting quietly and holding your rapier. It was full of unnecessary formality, even to your ninth house eyes, all antique niceties and duelling condescension that had been long forgotten back home. Ianthe was a saint of the third house, and Augustine an antique of the fifth. Neither did anything without putting down a little carpet first and introducing themselves to an audience of 1,000 quiet-eyed memorial bones, and you. But after the ceremony came the sword. You remembered so little of Nibiria's turn, either of his death or of his life. But from what you had gathered, he would have been the last cavalier in the whole starless universe to think his sword arm better off defleshed. Despite that, Ianthe was cured. It had been your faintest and most childlike hope that Ianthe would consider your bondage over, that your saving her life would be enough to release you from the collar of debt she had placed around your neck. "As if," she'd said, "when I ask, you will know you have been asked, Nona Jesimus." The saint of patience had held to his promise to gild the arm, and now you often caught Ianthe marvelling at her metal-shod finger-bones, at the buttery shine of gold upon her triquetrum. Your eldest sister, whose discomfort and annoyance only grew with Augustine's delight, confronted you about it in the corridors.
"Did you really erect that ghastly edifice?"
"Yes," you said.
"And it's really self-synthesizing bone?"
"Yes," you said.
"Though I wouldn't call the process synthesis when the construct is merely perpetually growing to fill a pre-realized skeletal map. It's yet more proof that topological resonance can be manipulated."
Mercy Morn's eyes narrowed to hurricane slits with short, thick lashes. Her prismatically white Canaanite robe was wrapped very tightly around her, as though she were cold, and she had bound back her peach-coloured hair as though it were a wimple. She said,
"I see."
And then,
"I see, I see. What's 2 plus 2?
4.
Smallest bone in the body. The auditory ossicles, but what's the name of the saint of duty?"
You said, "Autus the First," and you were too slow. She reached out and tapped you on the side of the head. What Mercy Morn the First could do with a simple tap on the side of the head might have meant your end far more easily than the saint of duty, a run-up, and his spear. But she said out loud,
"Autus,"
and then hurriedly again, all in one single, "Autus.
Autus."
The back of your skull ached, and you felt the chilly stab of pain in your sinuses that you sometimes felt in the dry atmosphere of the Mithraeum. You jerked away. Your fingers flew to the bone studs in your ears. But she was not attacking you. You, so aware of your body, could sense no gland overworking, nor chemical coursing, nor vessel constricting. The only change was in Mercy. Her placid oval face had taken on much the same look as you had seen, through a thin veil of viscera, the day you had fed the lictors your own marrow. She looked at you, quiet, and perhaps even a little lost, and she said,
"I can't tell if you're a once-in-a-lifetime genius, an insane imbecile, or both."
Then she said,
"Children as fists, infants as gestures. Yuck! Phew! I live in the worst of all possible worlds."
And without saying another word, Mercy Morn stalked off down the corridor in the opposite direction, the lights making rainbows of her tightly shrouded robes. When you reported this conversation to Ianthe, she was not particularly interested. This was, you thought, your sister saint's downfall. She had predefined a set of things that merited her attention and consideration, and everything else she put aside. "You brood over everything," she had said once to this accusation. "You read unholy omens in the way people say good morning." "She's a crank," said Ianthe. "Augustine says she went funny years ago, and that much like a stopped clock, she's right twice a day by coincidence. Avoid, avoid." How you loathed any sentence beginning with, "Augustine says."
"But she touched my head,"
you said. She was changing something, or looking for something, and I have no idea what.
Your brain, suggested Ianthe. Later, you lay together in her lavish bed, far apart enough that if you reached out your hand, you might just brush her with your fingertips. It was, you had admitted, the only place you now felt safe to sleep, what with your ward so eminently destroyable. The mockery you endured for needing her proximity was exquisitely painful, but humiliation was steadily becoming your existence whole and entire. But sleeping side by side was awkward. It had been her idea. You would have slept on the carpet if you hadn't thought it would leave you more vulnerable to the saint of duty. It would have been too easy to see you from the window in the case of a space-side assault. Trauma prevented you from simply taking a pillow and sleeping in the bathtub. You lay flat on your back in borrowed blankets, wearing third-hand clothes. Ianthe had given you a daffodil-coloured nightgown, rummaged from some ancient drawer of artifacts belonging to a long-dead lictor's cavalier. It made you look like a liver inflammation. You stared glumly at a painting opposite the bed of an exquisite woman with lots of ruddy golden hair, a dreamy smile and no clothes, though she was holding a rapier, and, for no reason you could see, a melon. That first night in her bed, you'd placed your bone-dressed sword between you and felt better. She had, unsurprisingly, ragged you for it. Relax, she had said. I haven't invited you to an orgy, Harrow. From this lying-down angle, the painting of the nude and obstreperously beautiful woman was in full sightline. You had murmured, I believe you. Albeit many wouldn't. This is why I cultivate you, Harrow Hark, she had remarked. The suspicion that you might possess a sense of humour. You had said, I'm not so gullible to think that your only reason. Of course I want something from you, but it's not personal, Ianthe had said. Understand me, Harry. I always take the smartest option first. Burn any bridges that need to be burned. Try to get in before anyone else can. It was the first thing I ever admired about you, back at... Well, I promised not to talk about that. I'm very good at seeing the big picture, and your being alive is, right now, part of my big picture. Both of you had stared in the bedtime silence of blankets and darkness, at the big picture in front of you. They're all self-portraits, you know, she had said gloomily. Cyrus the First and his cavalier constantly painted portraits of themselves and each other in the nude, hung them up everywhere, and gave them out to people for their birthdays. Augustine said Cyrus had them all brought over from Canaan House. Why do you keep them around? It is the type of energy I wish to take into my future, Ianthe had said. You both lay now in the low blue habitation light of the sleeping hours, not so close that you could semantically be said to be lying together. You were very aware of her nonetheless, of her skimmed milk hair and discontented mouth, and of the amber satin she wore that made her arm so gold and her veins so green. The saint of duty is killable, she said. You've shown that you're capable of killing him, even if you're not a genuine lictor. So, if it were up to me, he'd be dead already. You did not remotely believe this. The real problem is Teacher. I'm not sure you can kill Autus quickly enough to avoid Teacher bursting through the wall with a merry... Not on my watch, and bringing him back from a death blow. You said, then what do you propose? Distracting God? That is exactly what I propose, said Ianthe. At the sound you made, she continued eagerly, I mean it. Augustine says he'll do it.
I asked him as a favour to me, and he said yes.
Augustine said yes. Augustine agreed to the murder of his brother Lictor.
There are very complex power dynamics on this station, said your sister Lictor, with whom you had a very complex power dynamic. I told him the whole story. Don't make that face, Harry. It'll stick that way. And he said Altus was on too long a leash, and what he thought he was doing, Augustine didn't know, but that gunning for you was stupid when you're just going to be eaten by heralds anyway. Sorry. Direct quote. You said flatly, I appreciate the sentiment. In any case, he said they can get by with just 3 Lictors to take down number 7. So if I can step into Altus's shoes now that I'm not problematic, you can see I took my lumps, Nona Jesimus. He can buy you an hour after dinner.
When?
Tomorrow.
How?
Didn't say. But it's Augustine the First, my child. He's the first and oldest Lictor. These 3 are all the oldest and the last. That's why they're patience, joy, and duty. 3 virtues. If Augustine is going to distract God, that means he's going to distract God. He's very old and